Hey, welcome to the Chess Experience. On this show, it's all about helping adult improvers. I want to make learning chess easier for you to navigate, and I also want you to have a more fun experience along the way. I'm your host, Daniel Lona, a fellow chess amateur. Let's get to it. This show is sponsored by Chess.com, the world's largest chess community. One of Chess.com's most popular features is called Game Review. This feature weaves together a lot of benefits in one post-game analysis. For example, you can see how accurately you played, whether you made any moves that were deemed brilliant or great, which makes me feel a lot better about my chess when I get one of those. And Game Review also offers a virtual coach that gives insights on every move. It'll also show you alternate lines that would have been better for you to help you understand how you can improve your game. So go on chess.com, play a game, and try out the Game Review. Welcome to this week's show. Today, we have well-known chess coach and international master Kostya Kavutsky returning to the podcast. Kostya is one of three coaches or senseis who run the fantastic business called Chess Dojo. The Chess Dojo helps you improve your chess with amazing lessons and content on their Twitch and YouTube channels. And for the past couple of years, they've been well known for their online training program, which offers specific improvement plans for your rating level. There are links to all of Chess Dojo's great services and content in the show notes. In this episode, Kostya and I discuss a variety of topics. We cover Kostya's recent tournament experiences and improvement approach for his personal goals, including earning the GM title, what the modern chess economy can mean for adults who are considering careers in chess. Some talk on the 2024 candidates tournament, including the fairness of the qualifying process and Kostya's predictions for who might win. Here's my interview with Kostya. I hope you enjoy it. Hi, Kostya. How are you?
Hey, Daniel. Doing great. How are you?
I'm doing well. I am super excited to have you back on the show. As we just discussed a minute before starting this podcast, it was May of 2022 that you were last on the show. So a little under 2 years since we last spoke here. And like I also referenced, I'm excited to chat with you again. Well, for a lot of reasons. First of all, it's just cool to chat with you. But also in terms of what we talk about will be different this time. The last time you were on the show, we talked about how to effectively study annotated game books. And that was a great episode. Lots of people loved it. But this time we're just going to do a variety of topics. And so I'm kind of excited to talk about some new stuff with you and learn more about your own personal chess journey too.
Cool. Well, yeah, thanks for having me on. I hope to provide some value for people once again, hopefully.
Yeah, I'm sure you will, Kostya. You're an awesome chess coach, and you have lots of great insights into the chess world. And I think people also will be interested maybe to hear a little bit about your own chess journey, because I think, you know, similar, we create, you know, somewhat different types of content. I mean, I focus a lot on education too, although it's mostly other people providing the education, not me. But I think somewhat similar to me, Kostya, is that maybe we talk less about ourselves, right? And so I think maybe this would be a nice opportunity to have a chance for you to tell people a little bit about what's going on in your chess life. And to that point, I just kind of wanted to start right there because I know you've been doing tournaments and stuff. Like, just broadly speaking, what are you aspiring to in chess? What's motivating you to improve and things like that?
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, I basically have one goal in chess, and that is to get the next and final title, the GM title. That's been a goal of mine actually for many years, since I was maybe even before like Vidé Master, maybe when I was like around 2200 or so. I just felt like I wanted to pursue chess, and that seemed like the ultimate title to strive for. So that was always kind of the ultimate goal. And then FM, IM, these were like kind of huge milestones on the way, but GM has always just been kind of the ultimate goal for me. So I do get asked this a lot, but I'm happy to talk about it because I have no norms. You know, I'm really not like, there are IMs out there that are like much stronger than me that have like two norms, even three norms, and they're like actually close to 2,500 FIDE. For me, I'm like, you know, I've been circling around 2,400 for a while. I have no norms. You know, like I've been close to a norm a couple times, but not like, you know, I was like, oh, draw away, or I needed to just like not lose the final game or something like that. So I still have like a lot of work to do to get there. And the good news is that I still like chess. Like, I like exploring the game and learning new ideas and learning new, like, positions and end games and solving puzzles and all that stuff. So I'm, like, my main motivation right now is, like, I want to improve and become a better chess player. But yeah, obviously GM is, like, that's kind of the concrete, you know, aim that I would have in mind.
Yeah, yeah, that's awesome. Well, I love that that's a goal of yours. I think that's really inspiring and just exciting to see you pursue that. Are you working with a coach to help you get there?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not. which is probably not a good thing. I was working with coaches in like the past couple of years, and they've given me like directions, like, you got to work on this, you got to work on this thing. And I feel like right now I'm just like still working on those things. So I could get another coach to tell me, like, yeah, you got to work on your calculation, you got to work on your openings, you got to work on your end games. But it's like, yes, I already, you know, I'm already aware of these issues. It's like I'm working on. I do think a coach, though, would be extremely helpful. It's actually just hard to find someone that's like the right fit and yeah, like meets your needs and everything.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's something a lot of my audience can relate to, and I can too. You know, that's like half of it, right? Like, half of it is getting someone who's qualified and can do a good job with the coaching aspect. But yeah, there is just this kind of maybe somewhat intangible part of just being a good fit for your personality and style. It makes sense to me what you said, Kostya, that you know, you kind of got some of the standout points of what you need to work on. And so you kind of feel like coaching to hear the same thing would be a bit redundant at this point.
Yeah, I feel like ultimately it's up to me to do a ton of chess work, especially in terms of like trying to improve my calculation. There are tons of end games that I could, you know or understand much better, be more proficient with. And then openings, you know, I mean, at my level, like, I think it's kind of no joke. I mean, people are just studying openings all the time, basically. And I feel like they definitely make a difference at higher levels. It make a difference at lower levels too, of course, but I think, like, especially at higher levels, you know, it's just very difficult if you're not getting good positions out of the opening. It's also very frustrating if, like, you know, you play some line and it's like, you know, you've kind of looked at this a little bit, but not as deeply as you could have, and then here you are at the board and you just like don't know what you're doing. now you gotta like play this position and figure it out, you know, your first time OTB, which I think is not the best way to go about things.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that. Just one thing I'm kind of curious about, just in terms of your own personal approach to pursuing the GM title, obviously that requires a lot of study and practice at home. How do you approach it in terms of structure? Do you find that you're pretty structured in what you're going to do, like, for that week or month? Or are you a bit more casual in just maybe, you know, picking up a book here and there, working through some stuff and kind of just feeling your way through it?
Yeah, so the amount of time I have for training definitely oscillates quite a bit, but generally speaking, my structure actually is quite simple. You know, so we've got this dojo training program, and we have a plan for my rating level, basically to get from like 24 to 2500, and it consists of like a number of books and like sparring positions and game analysis, like annotating your games, you know, it's just a huge part of it. I have like 80 games I need to annotate for the program. So my work is actually like pretty clear cut. And whenever I have time for chess, ideally like once per day, I try to do something that's kind of like either part of the program or similar or like adjacent to it. Like I might read a book that's outside a program, but is still kind of like high level. Like lately I've been reading Dvoretsky's Recognizing Your Opponent's Resources, which is a pretty high level book. It's like basically a puzzle book. It's just testing calculation, but the problems are all about finding the opponent's resources, which is definitely rare for like puzzle books. Yeah, so the amount of training I do is kind of sporadic. You know, it's like I try to do a little bit every day these days, like basically like 1 or 2 hours of solid chess work. If I have time for more, I'll try to do more. But I'm always just kind of like balancing it with the dojo and like my work with dojo, streaming, making content, and then actually like managing the program. Like we got a bunch of students, we got multiple Discords, we got a Twitter account, YouTube, you know, all this stuff. So my time is very much split into like chess work and non-chess work.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, first of all, I think it's awesome that you are a student of your own program, which is very cool. Second, I didn't even know there was a, like, it went that advanced in the training program for 24 to 2500.
Oh, I don't think I scrolled down David that far. Me, David, and Jesse were, we're all technically in the program. Jesse is by far the most diligent, and he pushes us to kind of like follow it more. Me and David are behind, but yeah, the nice thing is that it's all kind of like laid out for us, so there's no like confusion, like, oh, what should I study, what should I look at. It's all like, no, I have like a bunch of tasks to do right there, which is very nice.
Yeah, that's great. And we'll definitely be touching on the training program later in our conversation. I also want to ask you just about kind of your OTB experiences, because I've noticed that you've played in several this past year, both in the U.S. and abroad. Just a few questions about that. First, what factors do you consider when you're deciding which tournaments you'll play in?
Yeah, the main one I would have to say is probably, I guess I consider a couple of things. Of course, I want to mainly play in events where I can face stronger players. So the event needs to have like a good number of title players like IMs or GMs. The main way I end up choosing events is usually just based on cost, just because like travel costs are pretty hefty these days. And to get to a tournament, it's like flight, hotel, sometimes entry fee as well. Not always for me, but sometimes. And so, but usually like the flight and hotel are already like quite burdensome. So, the way I choose tournaments is I just try to find strong events that are not that expensive to play.
That sounds like a perfect combination. So I know that you did at least three video recaps of tournaments that you attended in the past year. There may have been more that I missed or that you attended and just weren't made into content. But what was your favorite OTB tournament that you played in this past year, like over the past 12 months, and whatever criteria you want to assess that on?
Yeah, I mean, so, well, basically, just to go back a bit, like before the pandemic, I was actually playing in Europe quite often. Like I played Reykjavik a couple times, I played Gibraltar, and these were just like fantastic events. I played a couple other events in like France and so on. And then when the pandemic hit, like I just didn't get a chance to go to Europe for several years. Just recently, I played these two events in Europe, one in Sitges, Spain, which is near Barcelona. And that was just the Sunway Sitges Chess Festival. The other one was the Rilton Cup, which is held over the New Year in Stockholm, Sweden. Both were great events. These were definitely like my two favorite events. It's kind of a little bit unfair just because like I had multiple years of just exclusively US events, and then I finally got to go to Europe and play these two tournaments. And it's no secret the conditions in Europe tend to be nicer than the average US event. Not that US events are nice. There are plenty of places in the US running really, really like awesome events. St. Louis is one example. Charlotte is another example, and there are other places as well. But just in terms of the schedule, generally, U.S. events are going to be two rounds per day. European events are often one round per day, and that just makes a huge difference. You know, I don't have a regular job that I'm skipping or school or anything. You know, I'm a chess player. So for me, just like being able to play just one round per day, you prepare for it, you play it, you know, like a elite player, and then afterwards you have time to review the game. You can even review it like over the board with your opponent. Because you have time for that, and then still have a normal dinner, and then still have time to rest and prepare for the next game. It's just a much more enjoyable experience than showing up. You know, the pairings go up 5 minutes before the first game. You sit down to play. You like barely know your opponent's name, let alone like the ratings sometimes. Like, you know, you got to play this game. It ends. You have an hour for the next game. You know, you got to go eat something. You know, it's just totally different experience there. So it's a little bit unfair, but also these locations were very nice that I played in, especially Sitges, Spain. I mean, it was during the winter and it was warm there. We were on the beach. So it was just nice. It was just a very, very, enjoyable experience. Rilton Cup was also fantastic, and it was just kind of right in the middle of Stockholm, so we were able to see a lot of the city, and it's very pretty during the Christmas time. So yeah, that was also just like a fantastic tournament.
Yeah, that sounds like a great experience out in Europe for these tournaments. A couple things you brought up there, Kostya, that I'd love to talk about with respect to these formats and styles. It is a perfect timing too, because I was just going to ask you about that. This thing of in Europe, how it seems like most of the OTB tournaments have one game per day. And obviously in the US, as you know, and I'll just say this for anyone who's not in the US, may not know, typically you have the, like you said, these weekend tournaments where you have two a day. It's like one on Friday, two Saturday, two Sunday. So yeah, you already answered my question about which format you prefer, and it definitely makes sense to me. Couple of questions to follow up on that. One is, do we have any hope in the US of getting that format? Because I really, like you, I really appreciate the one a day for all the reasons that you said.
Yeah, so I actually think there are quite a few number of events in Europe that do have multiple rounds per day. I think it's just they have more of these events that are one round per day, and because they're so unique, we just kind of single them out in the US. But or what they'll often have is they'll have a mix. So a tournament might be like 6 or 7 days, and I'll have like maybe a couple of single round days and then one or two double round days. So it's just like not as intense. But yeah, in the US, unfortunately, it's tough. You do have the US Open. I think that's the one tournament that like yearly has a one round per day schedule. Unfortunately, that round is at 7 p.m. So it's like, really, I don't know. It doesn't feel like the best time. The problem is because you're always going to be anxious leading up to the game. So you can't really do a whole lot. You just want to like kind of prepare. Whereas if you just had the game earlier, then you could just go play the game. And then afterwards, you can rest a bit, you know, you have some time.
Exactly.
But yeah, there are tournaments like occasionally that will do this like one round per day schedule, but yeah, it's just not very cost effective, of course. You know, they have to pay the hotel fees and the rental fees and all, and then people, of course, have to travel for longer and take longer off of work. I don't know. I mean, these days, a lot of people work from home, like they work remotely. So I feel like there is some room in the schedule for some kind of event, like where if you imagine the game was at like 3 or 4 p.m., then people that needed to, they could take that like morning time to get some work done. So it's not like they're totally taking off work, but then they would also have time to like prep and play the game. I don't know. Maybe something to experiment
right.
with.
Well, in the absence of that changing, one thing that I've done, because I so much prefer one a day, and I find I play better too with that, is I've just taken like at least one bye. If it allows only one bye, just do one bye and just make one of those days one game. So that way, like Friday's one day and then maybe Saturday's, or I'm sorry, Friday's only one game and then maybe Saturday's only one game. Mm-hmm. So it kind of gets there. But that's just been my own personal strategy because I so much more prefer it, like you said. Yeah, one other question I had for you, Kostya, about OTB is that you're an IM, so obviously to get to that point, you have to be very seasoned with OTB classical tournaments, and you are. So I cannot but wonder at that level, the level you're at, are there still any aspects of playing in that setting, OTB classical, that you find you're still working on, such as nerves? Or have you just done it so many times now that you kind of gotten a handle on sort of the non-chess related stuff that goes into it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think in general, I'm pretty comfortable with playing OTB. There are definitely different levels to it. Like the first time you play a title player, you're often like pretty nervous. And first time you play like IM, first time you play GM, first time you play on like a DGT board that's like being broadcasted. Now I've gotten like pretty fairly used to these things, though I would say I still get nervous when I'm playing like a really strong player, like 2600, 2700, just because I feel like, you know, one mistake and it's just like game over basically. So I'm sure I could have like more experience with facing high rated players. I think I also end up giving them a little bit too much credit. This is more of a chess mistake I think I make, but I kind of give them too much credit, you know, during the game and think like, oh, all their ideas are working, and evaluating every position in their favor slightly. So yeah, no, in terms of like nerves and stuff like that, I mean, I think everyone can basically improve. Like I definitely get nervous during like time trouble situations and things like that. Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that's kind of comes with the game, and it comes with more experience. Like in general, it's gotten better for me as I've gotten more experience. I've now been in winning positions enough times that, like, you know, I don't get as nervous. It's like the first time you have a winning position against a grandmaster, it's like, you know, your hands are gonna shake, like you're definitely gonna feel something. But now I would say it's like less. It's not totally gone away, but it's less.
Yeah, that makes sense. So yeah, I just want to now move on to a different topic, although I'd love to keep talking about that one. The training program, Chess Dojo's training program, which I'm not exactly sure on the date of launch, but I suspect it's been at least a couple of years now. But notably last year in 2023, you released an updated version of the training program, a 2.0 version. And, you know, you've had many folks in your program along the way. You know, obviously the three of you knew a ton about how to help people with their chess before it was even launched. And that's why you were able to launch such a program. But I also imagine that, you know, in the years that you've had it, you've probably, you know, refined what you've learned or maybe gained some new insights. So to that end, what are perhaps some new insights that you've gained in, you know, just how to more effectively help people get better at chess?
Yeah. So, right, to answer your question, so we launched in May 2022. And so 2023, that was like our 2.0. So it's, yeah, easy to remember. That was just like after 1 year of existence, we kind of like upgraded our stuff, moved to like a real site, whereas before we were kind of tracking everyone with like Google spreadsheets, which is like fun, but yeah, like moving to a real site was nice. And we're now coming up on our 3.0, which is slated for May, where I don't think there's going to be any like, you know, huge changes like last time, but I mean, hopefully we'll just be able to update and upgrade some things. But basically, I mean, it's been a wonderful journey. Like we had a nice chunk of members from the start, and we've since grown. These days we're around like 1,500-1,600 members in the program, which is pretty cool.
That's incredible. Congrats on that.
Yeah. Thank you. Not everyone is active, of course. So it's like, you know, we have this Discord for members of the training program, and definitely not everyone makes it to the Discord or even wants to use it, because it's like this extra tech. But yeah, we definitely could use more members, because it's like the more people that are in the program, a big thing is we have is sparring, where it's like we really try to focus on the value of just like training with other people in a context where it's not rated. Right. So just like playing training games against another person, especially if it's kind of like from a thematic middle game or an end game or an opening position, we just think like this is super useful. But of course, it's hard for people to find training partners, as I've, you know, realized many years ago. A lot of people are just like, they're kind of, you know, on their own. They might have like a chess club or something, but they don't really like know a lot of people. So they got to go online. And then, it's not easy to like find people around your level to spar with, but if you can, then it's like just tremendous value. This is just great practice.
Even harder to find people who want to play a classical game with you too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, yeah, if you just play like the classical pool online, you know, it's just kind of totally random what you might get. People are generally either like playing too fast, or they're looking at their opening book during the game, and it's kind of obvious. It's like
right.
It's not easy to find like, yeah, trustworthy, reliable, classical games. And, it's been really fun, like building out the program. As I mentioned, I'm working with Grandmaster Jesse Cry, David Pruis. I mean, I think you've had them both on, so hopefully people.
Yes, they've both been on. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, it's been super fun. You know, it's like we don't always agree on everything in terms of like how the real challenge has been. It's just like there's so many different, you know, we're telling people what to do with their chess. Like here are the tasks you need to do to like improve your chess. And we're trying to like lay it out for them and give them like guides basically. our difficulty from the beginning is that, like, you know, like, real chess improvement is not very glamorous or flashy, and it's not super, like, fun or fat. Like, it's not Bullet, right, and Puzzle Rush. Like, that stuff's fun, but that's not, generally, that doesn't lead to, like, real chess improvements. Real chess improvement is generally kind of, like, hard, like, tedious. You know, it's, like, a little frustrating. Yeah. Like, you're kind of, like, pushing against, like, you know, a wall, and it's, like, you don't know if you, like, you can do it. It's just, like, difficult. And so our challenge has been to kind of not soften that, you know, while, like, making it a little bit more fun for people to, like, track their progress and do it with, you know, others around their level, and be able to kind of, like, you know, gamify their journey a bit, which is what we've done with the site. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's like, it's a lot of responsibility. You know, we're telling people what to do. here's how you should spend your time. Like, here's what to work on in terms of chess. And students, you know, they often have their own, like, ideas about what they should be doing. They don't often like what we're suggesting. We have to kind of, like, force it on them, you know, push them, like, trust the program.
Right. Well, I mean, one thing that was interesting to me, you may have noticed that it was in the past week or two, I released the episode with adult improver Sam, who is in your program. And she said that her favorite aspect of the training program was that is that she likes that it tells you what to do, because that was, like, her big challenge for her before joining, was that, you know, the seemingly infinite number of chess resources out there was a bit overwhelming. And so she wanted, you know, a trusted source like you guys to just say, okay, here's what you should be doing at your level. So for what it's worth, it seems like, I'm guessing that she's probably representative of at least a good chunk of people who are in your program that are, you know, kind of happy to have that guidance and just be, quote unquote, told what to do.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That was definitely one of the main main tenets of the program, is that, yeah, there's a lot of like consumer confusion in chess, where there's all these different sites and products, and you see it all the time where people are they're kind of, like, jumping to a new thing, like, every single week. Whereas, like, yeah, people have been improving at chess for many, many years. And, like, you know, the few things that have been consistent throughout time, it's, like, analyzing chess positions, going over your games, reading chess books, you know, analyzing, like, high-level games, training with others. Like, these are the things that have been around for many, many years. It's just recently we've, you know, we've seen the rise of, like, engines and like, all this AI stuff, of course. And, yeah, I think definitely a lot of people like that, you know, we just kind of lay it out for them very simply. So it's kind of a balance, because it's not like, it's definitely not like there's only one way to improve at chess. So it's not like you have to follow our program step by step, or otherwise you won't improve, right? So it's right. It's clear that you could do many other things and still improve at chess. So it's kind of like finding that balance of, like, you know, here's what's flexible, here's, like, what we, like, really strongly recommend, here's what's just, like, non-negotiable, and then kind of laying that out for people clearly.
Sure. Has there been anything that you've observed over the past, I guess, almost 2 years at this point of running the training program that has surprised you in terms of what's effective for helping people improve, either on one end of the spectrum where you say, oh, I didn't think that would be as helpful as it was, but it seems to be making a big impact with people, or the opposite, where there's something you thought would almost certainly be effective, but maybe it was a little less so than you had hoped?
So Jesse, Grandmaster Jesse, does these weekly graduation shows where he just goes through all the people that have graduated from one cohort to another during that week. So the way the program works is we have these 100-point rating bands, and we have a different plan for every 100 points. So if you're, like, 1152, you're trying to get to 1200. Once you get to 1200, you have a new plan to follow to get from 12 to 1300. The plans don't vary a ton from one to another. Like, a lot of times we'll have books that kind of overlap across multiple plans, and, you know, a lot of them have to study the same end games, but there are different things, and, you know, you have to do a little bit more of everything generally as you go up the ranks. But anyway, so Jesse does these weekly grad shows where he highlights people that are graduating and then goes through one of their games, or maybe even a few, just to see, like, what kind of games they're uploading. we ask every student to annotate their games and then upload them to the database so that others can see them as well. And so Jesse will pick out a handful and take a look at them. And so this show has been awesome. Then he started doing another show called, I think it was like the Top of the Cohort show. And that's where he just kind of highlights like one member from every group that's like gaining the most, like doing the most work, and just kind of takes a look at their progress. And I thought this show was like, eh, whatever. You know, I didn't think it would be like a big deal, but no, people are like gunning for that spot. You know, they're vying, they want to be the top of the cohort. So it's like this, I didn't totally anticipate. I feel like competition actually is like, can be really helpful sometimes. Even if it's just kind of randomly generated, because it just it just pushes people to do more work and achieve more. And it's just like, just like highlighting these like random performances from time to time, like it really motivates people to get a lot done.
Yeah. As you say that, I'm not maybe as surprised that could be, that type of competition could be a motivator, just because unlike, if it was something more numerical, like with our ratings, that can often cause us stress or anxiety. If it was like who gained the most rating points, I think that would be a much more stressful thing. But just doing more work, I don't know, it's sort of like it's competition, but it's not stressful. So it kind of makes sense to me that would be an effective motivator for people.
Yeah. People want to be top of the cohort,
Yeah, exactly. So one more question I had for you about the training program, because you said, this past year you did an update 2.0. Was that more in the realm, the updates that you made, were they more in the realm of kind of just making it a smoother user experience? Or was there also some substantive changes to like the actual study plan itself?
Yeah. So yeah, definitely the big shift was like moving everyone to a real website. And then on the site we have, back then it was new. It was this like kind of shared group calendar. That's kind of amazing where, we have like over 1,000 members in the site, but they can all kind of use this one calendar to organize like training sessions, and people can post when they're free and what they're available to do. And I think that is really kind of, boosted like participation and retention. We definitely changed quite a bit in terms of the study plan as well. We just kind of polled everyone and asked them like, what are your least favorite books? What books do you think we should add to the program? Is there anything we should change? In general, people gave a ton of suggestions. I think we actually we're doing this now for 3.0. I believe we used Reddit. We just put up a post on Reddit and ask people to just upvote and downvote their like their favorite ideas or suggestions in terms of like the material. So we took out a couple of books that people didn't like. One book was How to Beat Your Dad at Chess, which we recommended, I think, for players rated around like 900 or 1,000 FIDE or so. And for whatever reason, people voted it out. But now people are trying to vote it back in for Dojo 3.0.
Oh, really?
So it's fun. Yeah, we're definitely following this latest drama.
People didn't voice like what they didn't like about it that got it removed?
No, they did. I think they had some reasons. I think Jesse wasn't a huge fan of the book either. Personally, I like it. I mean, it has like, just some good examples of like tactical play, and I think it's maybe not great as like a puzzle book just in terms of how it's structured, but I don't know. I thought the material is good. It's kind of a classic, but
yeah, I've always heard about it. Yeah, for sure. Well, that's interesting to see if it makes it back in the training program after the groundswell of support that it now has.
Yeah, exactly. I thought that was very curious that people are now rallying to get it to get it back in.
That's funny.
And I think one of the bigger, I would say, like substantial changes we made is we definitely shifted a lot of the material so that it reaches multiple groups. So we took a lot of books. Like one book, for example, is like Reassess Your Chess by Silman. I think before we like recommended that at like just the 1500 level or just the 1600 level or something like that. And now for 2.0, it's like, no, I mean, you can read this book whether you're 1500, 1600, 1700. So we widened the ranks where it would be useful. Oh. So multiple levels could read it.
Interesting.
Because it didn't really make sense to us that, like, you know, you can join the program at like 1602 and then not read reassess your chess. But if you join it at 1598, then you do have to read it. And it's like, it's such a tiny difference. So we basically like widened a bunch of the books to have multiple levels read them.
Well, that strikes me as one of the most helpful things that the training program offers. I mean, there's many things, so it's hard for me to pick what would be like the most appealing, because all of it is, frankly, from my perspective. But I noticed that that's like a very common challenge if you're trying to improve on your own, and sometimes even when you're with a coach, because it's not like they're there with you weighing in on every resource available, which is to know like what's level appropriate, what resources are level appropriate for you. I think that's one of the hardest things to discern when you're on your own. And the fact that that's, you know, a big part of, I think, what the training program does is it tells you, here's the level appropriate resources for you. Yeah, I just think that's a huge benefit. Have you gotten similar feedback on that?
Yeah, it is kind of a shame. I think my coach sensei David has made this point before where he's like, every chess book should just be named like, reassess your chess, 1200 to 1800. You know, it just tells you like exactly
yes.
what level it's made for, which I think makes sense. Yeah, it's a bit of a shame. I mean, I don't think it's like, you know, intentional, but yeah, you do often see people being very confused. And I totally get it because I have the same experience with my journey in the fitness world, where I'm like the average adult fitness improver, where I like don't really know what I'm doing. I'm like trying different stuff, you know. It's like I'm constantly Googling like what's the best fitness plan or like what are the best fitness apps, and then I just get these random results. You know, I have no idea how to judge like which program is actually good or not, and it feels like there's a ton of free resources. So like, do I really even like need to pay for something? Like maybe I could just follow like a free plan, and yeah, you know, it's like, and I'm sure right. like the same things. Like I imagine, you know, there's like these like very like typical, you know, principles you could follow in the fitness world, right? It's just like exercise a lot, you know, try to eat healthy, just like sleep well, like very simple stuff you could follow. But people are chasing these like crazy plans and apps and stuff.
Yeah.
But
yeah, well, it's a great service that the dojo provides on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think thankfully it's not too hard if you ask around. Like people will generally, I think, be pretty straightforward about what every resource is for. I think, you know, maybe the big miss nowadays is like you probably have people buying like a few too many like courses and books that are like much higher level than where they're currently at. Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's like necessarily a bad thing if they can afford it and they like, you know, just like collecting books and stuff, then that's fine. But if they're just, instead confused about what's like appropriate for their level, then that's definitely a bit of a shame.
Right, right. Well, yeah, I'm just super impressed, Kostya, with all that you're doing with the training program, along with, you know, you and Jesse and David, and what you're contributing with that to the chess community. I think it's really needed, and it just seems to me that, you know, you're the best in the business at it in terms of providing this structured program that, you know, that people can use. And yeah, I just want to commend you for that. I've done it myself. It's amazing. I'm sure it'll just keep getting better as you keep fine tuning it over the years.
Well, thanks. Yeah. I feel like, we got a good thing going, and yeah, we're definitely, we're still super like kind of pumped about it, because we feel like, you know, people have gained a lot of rating, and so it feels like the program has worked for a lot of people, and we've got a ton of nice like testimonials and stuff. So it feels like it's working. You know, we weren't like really sure at the start that it would, but I mean, you know, people have done the work and made the gains. Yeah, I mean, obviously full credit goes to the community. They're the ones that actually like, they're the ones that had to like read Silman and like study the books and go to tournament. Like, you know, we gave them the program, but they're the ones that actually like had to actually like follow it and, you know, get it done.
Right. So yeah, now I just like to discuss a couple of, I don't know exactly what the right phrase is for this, but just some salient topics in the chess community, a couple of which you've addressed on Chess Dojo. I'm not exactly sure how I should call it. Is that like your stream and then it becomes a YouTube video? But like your dojo talks, basically.
Our podcast.
Yeah. Okay. I'll call it your podcast then. Yeah. So your podcast, that's where you do the dojo talks, right? That's where it's released.
Yeah. Basically, right? we stream it. We stream it live, but then we release it as like a regular pod, like on Spotify and YouTube and everywhere else.
Okay. Gotcha. But a couple of topics that you've brought up have been great. And, I just wanted to touch on them because I love that you just dive into these relevant issues as well in the chess community. One of which is basically kind of on the subject of the modern chess economy, I guess you could say. And you had this discussion, a deep dive discussion on it with Hikaru, which is an amazing guest.
Yeah.
And that was a fantastic episode that you three did. And the focus was, just for people who don't know, the focus was on, you know, how the recent chess boom has affected careers and incomes for those who are making a living from chess. My own observation of that is there's a pretty broad spectrum of who that can affect, from top GMs to coaches to maybe even adult club players. So a couple of questions for you in this topic. First, how do you feel the chess dojo is affected by the chess boom, if it's even been affected?
Oh yeah, I think we've been affected a lot. I mean, we started basically in March 2020, right when the pandemic was kind of hitting, and then the chess boom happened. I think it started to happen it was later that year that like Queen's Gambit came out, but it was already starting to happen a little bit because people were at home and starting to pick up chess more often. So there's definitely a good chunk of people that were picking up chess right before Queen's Gambit. And then I think that's why Queen's Gambit maybe was such a huge success, because people were already kind of like getting into it. And then the show was obviously amazing. A ton of people entered from that as well. I don't know. I imagine we felt the effects. I mean, we definitely got a ton of fans that were like, you know, they came into our channel. They were like, oh yeah, you know, I was like on Levy's stream. Now I'm here. You know, they're watching like Gotham Chess. So like 100% we've had, folks kind of like funnel in from, let's say, much, much bigger channels like Hikaru, Levy, and so on.
Yeah, just an observation about that. I feel like the most recent chess boom that we've had, the one we're talking about, is just so helped greatly by technology. The counterexample to me is if the Queen's Gambit as a show, obviously it wouldn't have been a Netflix streaming show, but if it had come out, say, like in the early 2000s, it certainly would have raised the popularity of chess. But I just feel like the technology that we have, where we have YouTube channels streaming on Twitch and things like that, just gives it legs that it wouldn't have otherwise. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And just the fact that, you know, people can now just, well, I mean, I didn't realize this, you know, until like not that long ago, but, you know, people can just download the chess app on their phone and start playing chess. Like, I've been playing chess my whole life. You know, I never needed to download the chess app.
You know? You didn't need an app to play chess.
Yeah. So, I mean, I obviously downloaded the chess.com app like many years ago, but I mean, you know, I just didn't realize. Yeah, it's like it's become incredibly accessible for people, which I was not anticipating. Like growing up in the chess world, it was always, you know, just kind of like a side hobby, and then something people just played on weekends, you know, in like hotels. Mm-hmm.
Right. Right.
That was it.
I mean, I love the conversation that you had with Hikaru, and I just think it is such a fascinating one. And obviously, like, he can more easily speak to like how the chess boom has affected sort of the chess economy at the top level where he's at as a top player and a top chess streamer. But, you know, having an adult improver focused show, I'm kind of interested on the other end of the spectrum and what kind of effect that may have for adult improvers in terms of, I guess you could say, an economy or careers. And I think you have a pretty good finger on the pulse of this too, because like all of your customers are, you know, in the training program, or, well, I shouldn't say all of them, but probably a majority of them are adult improvers. And so I'm just kind of curious what you think this boom in the modern chess economy looks like for adult improvers, because many wish they could be a top player, but that's probably not in the cards. But that said, I think there's chess career potential now that wasn't there before. And I'm just curious to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, now, yeah, you don't have to be like a super strong player to be a chess content creator. And you never had to be a strong player to be a chess teacher.
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
So, that was definitely the big kind of like, let's say, career option that was always open to club players, was just to teach a lot, like, let's say, in schools or private lessons, the cool thing is that now that's not the only thing that you can do. You can also obviously make content on YouTube and stuff. And there are many, like, you know, let's say, like, lower rated creators that are obviously hugely successful because they're good communicators, you know, and good teachers and so on. So there's definitely, there's definitely tons of room. And
Lula's created a big audience, for example.
Yeah, Lula. Okay, I mean, I was thinking like Agan Mater, you know.
Yeah. different definitions of lower level player, obviously.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I was just thinking like just non-titled. Obviously, he's, stronger still than the masses.
By a lot, yeah.
There's even like much, much lower rated players. And Lula's not even that much lower rated, but even far lower than her. I mean, I think there is room. Also there's people that are just, they don't pretend to be teachers. They're just documenting their journey, like as they try to improve. And I think people definitely find that extremely interesting as people just kind of show like what they're doing, what they're working on. To be honest, it's like when you just have kind of like a small YouTube channel, it is hard to imagine how you do end up monetizing that if you don't really make it big. I think for a lot of people, it's like, it's kind of just a hobby, right? It's just something they're doing on the side. Like they do a little bit of chess, they document it a bit, they kind of follow, you know, they track their journey, and it might not be a forever thing. So I feel like if they really want to make it like a lasting career, then at some point, they have to get into some kind of like teaching content, I would imagine.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. A question that I'm often asked a lot from people who are like aren't in the chess community, or at least don't have their finger on the pulse of it, I guess, what's the state of the chess boom now compared to that first year after the Queen's Gambit came out? And I have a little trouble assessing that because I don't know, I feel like I'm in my own little adult improver bubble. So maybe I can get your take on that, because I think maybe you have a broader perspective and insight than I do. Do you feel like we are still riding that wave of the boom? Has it like mostly tapered off at this point?
Yeah, I'm not totally sure. I know like it is hard to judge, because if you look at our YouTube numbers on YouTube, we've just been kind of steadily growing without like huge spikes. So it wasn't like we started spiking a ton during any particular booms. But we've just been kind of steadily moving up. I would say on Twitch, if anything, from what I've heard, is numbers are kind of down a bit from what they were before. Like people are generally seeing that they have less viewers. I don't know if we're like coming down off of the boom. From my perspective, it feels like we're still, the chess world is doing extremely well, just because of all the tech. So there was definitely levels to like the chess boom. Like I remember, I mean, even before the pandemic, it already felt like things were changing because there's so much more streaming. There's a lot more like esports events starting up. Chess.com was doing more things. So it already felt like it's shifting in this like Twitch direction. Then of course pandemic happened, and I think Twitch got a lot bigger during those years. Queen's Gambit, of course, we saw a huge spike, and then even just like much more recently, there was a bigger boom compared to like the Queen's Gambit. Like just towards the end of, I think it was just towards the end of 2022 and the beginning of 2023, there was just this like even more insane boom, which I don't even know if we figured out the reasons yet. A lot of people were thinking it's like TikTok, because in particular, like Levy, you know, his videos were just getting like millions and millions of views, and so a lot of kids were getting into chess based off of that. And a ton of people also noticed that like kids started playing chess like in their classrooms. Like this became like an epidemic actually, like of like kids just being distracted because they're on their phones playing chess, which is wild. Then I heard from like college kids that people are like playing chess at college parties, which back in my day never happened. You know, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It only happened if like, okay, if like I was there and it was like a small party and it was like, oh, Kosti is a chess player. Let's play chess with Kosti. You know, that's how it could happen. But no, like it wasn't. It's never been a thing. So I feel like we're still definitely going strong based off that. I mean, I have, let's say, like civilian friends, you know, and they're still playing chess and they're still curious. You know, they ask me about like Hans and stuff like that, you know.
sure.
And yeah, I feel like I don't know how well Twitch is doing, but I feel like streaming in general is doing pretty well because now we just started streaming on YouTube, but you can obviously stream, you know, Instagram, like TikTok as well. And so I feel like streaming is still doing quite well as an activity.
Well, those are great insights, Kosia. And I want to also add one thing. I love that you called non-chess players civilians. I think we should make that a normal a normal term. That's great.
Yeah.
So the other kind of current event topic that I wanted to talk about with you with chess is regarding the candidates, specifically the qualifying process this year. Obviously, there was a lot of drama that happened. I just kind of want to get like maybe a quick take on it with you, because I know that this is a subject that we could make this a whole episode, but just sort of a, you know, just your sort of your brief overview on it. I know that this, you know, the candidates qualifying process is probably always something that, you know, people have ideas on and how to be improved or tweaked. But you know, there was a lot more that raised people's eyebrows this year. So what's your opinion of how things unfolded? Did you feel that it was ultimately a legitimate process?
Yeah, I definitely think it was ultimately legitimate. My feelings on the world championship cycle is that it's always just been kind of messy. You know, you started from periods when the world champion could just deny requests, you know, if they weren't feeling it, or like, you know, they could ask the challenger to have to raise just exorbitant amounts of money. So a lot of challenges just didn't take place, even though you had, let's say, the two best players in the world. So we've gone from like things like that to like potentially people like throwing games in like the candidates, like, you know, to ensure a certain winner makes it out to the final, like, you know, in the 40s and 50s, it's been like alleged. And like, so you've had like this kind of stuff, and like, it's always been messy. You know, Magnus dropped out of the candidate cycle many years ago because he didn't like the format. And so he didn't have like the number one player in the world playing the candidates. Not recently, but many years ago, you know, before he was world champion. So lately, you know, you had this like drama with Ferruja. And then even, okay, the previous year, like we had this drama with Ding Liren, where Ding, you know, played these like 30 games in China and just made it to the candidates just off like a last ditch throw and just ends up winning the whole thing. And so this year, yeah, you look Ferruja playing these like matches in France, you know, and Dominguez, you know, entering the Sitges tournament where I was playing. I mean, to me that was just like fun. I don't know. I mean, it doesn't feel like the most like kind of professional like sporting system when you have like players at the end of the year just like fishing for tournaments, like trying to like organize stuff like last minute. But I don't think it's like, you know, this is the only year where, you know, some shady stuff has gone down.
Gotcha. So basically it sounds like you're saying that, it's always been at least a somewhat flawed process, and this year wasn't particularly worse than the flaws that happened in the past.
Yeah, exactly. Like I'm glad that they have changed things up for next time. Where I think now what they switched was like they're going to take the 6 month rating average instead of just the rating of one month in the calendar. So you won't get this kind of like end of year race situations. I mean, I don't know. I still don't think it's like perfect. I mean, I think they're giving like 3 spots to the World Cup, which feels like a lot to me for such a you know, somewhat random tournament, but
It's good to get your insights on that. For sure. I'll just ask you one other question about the candidates, although nothing, you know, directly drama related, but rather just your expectations for the tournament this year. I know it can be a difficult tournament to predict, but that said, just for the fun aspect of it, if you had to pick two players who you thought had the best chances of winning it, who would they be?
So I'm just looking at the lineup right now, and I mean, it's a very interesting field. Not for the first time, I mean, I'm like looking at it, but, you know, right. You have, I would say like, let's say three veterans like Fabi, Nepo and Naka playing, because they've all played candidates events before. And I think for everyone else, it's okay. Farouj also played before, but he's still pretty young. For everyone else, Gukesh, Vidit, Abasov, Prague, this is all their first time. And from what we've seen and from like the last several candidates tournaments is that they're always like very nervy. There's like lots of mistakes. Players do some strange things, you know, they give away points almost. And so generally feels like the experience factor matters quite a bit, because both Fabi and Nepo, they were doing really well last time. Like Nepo, of course, ended up winning. Fabi kind of like collapsed in the second half, but he was gunning for first place. It was his whole thing. But in the first half, he was doing quite well. And Naka, I think, also has just been, you know, he had like the best chess year of anyone last year, I think, in classical. And he was doing really well in the previous candidates as well. So I feel like Naka, of course. So I would definitely pick one of these three, like Nepo, Fabi, or Naka in terms of my pick. And then if I had to pick two, I got to go with like Fabi and Nepo as just being the most likely. Sure. With Hikaru maybe being like a close third. Not to take anything away from the younger kids, it's just like from what we've seen, it feels like experience really does count, and players get really nervous, and I mean, chess is super hard, especially when there's like a lot on the line, you know.
That's great. I love the predictions. Next, I'd just like to do a couple of follower questions that were asked for you,
yeah,
Kostya, on Twitter. Mm-hmm. There was a few good ones. It's hard to pick. I'm just going to do two right now. The first one is from Twitter username Ant Hammer. He or she asks, is having a decent handle on your openings at about 1700 and up more important now than it was 10 years ago, given the resources now available?
Yeah, I would say like in general, I think, okay, the other two senseis, Dave and Jesse, they're going to torture for this, but I would say, I don't know, in my experience, no, they'd probably agree. In general, like, I feel like the importance of openings has gone up in the last couple of years. Main thing that comes to mind is like, nowadays there's a lot of, just kind of like annoying weapons out there, like London System, Jobava London, things like that. And especially at this level, like 17, 1800, you know, you'll have players that are kind of, you know, booked up with certain lines that might be annoying to face if you really don't know anything about them. So I'm not saying you need to spend all your time like studying all these like random sidelines or stuff like that, but like, you know, in general, having some idea of what you're doing in the opening, I think, is going to be helpful. It also just makes, in my experience, the game more enjoyable when you actually like your position from the opening, or at least you feel like you know what you're playing for. And then that might lead you to just play better chess or even play more chess because you enjoy the games more, just like analyze more, whatever. But yeah, I mean, I think, like, you know, generally, people spend a lot of time on openings. The main thing I would suggest not to do is to spend time memorizing lines that you haven't seen during your games. So If you're working on an opening and you're like memorizing variations, like, it better be something that, like, you know, literally like your club opponent is like playing against you like week after week. And that's why you're studying it. Yeah. I don't think people should be studying like just random variations that like they don't see just in case they come up, because I think that's truly just not a great use of time. I think the best use of time is just kind of studying model games in one's openings and then trying to pick up as many ideas as possible from that. So rather than studying variations, maybe a good example is like Italian game. You know, Italian games, there's just like a million different move orders and there's like all these nuances, but I think trying to like memorize stuff is not going to be nearly as helpful as just like playing through games, analyzing them, understanding where one side got the advantage, what happened, what would have happened against other possible defenses from the opponent, and just going through like master level games, I think generally is going to be the most useful thing when it comes to the opening. And basically like just treating the opening and middle game as kind of like one, almost like a combined stage, right? Like a successful opening is one where you get a middle game that you understand how to play. You know, generally you're not just going to win games out of the opening. You only do that if your opponent just completely blunders, right? So in general, a successful opening is one where you get a middle game position where it's like, you know what to do, you know what your plan is. And then from there, you know, you give it your best shot and you try to outplay your opponent. And if they outplay you because they're better than you, that's fine. But it's like, you don't blame the opening for that. So I think the more focus people actually put on the middle games that they're often getting, I think the better. Because people often use this logic. They're like, I'm going to get an opening every single game, so I should study the opening. But I would actually flip it a little bit. I would say, like, you don't know which variation you're going to get during the game, but you do know if you play the Sicilian, you're going to get a Sicilian middle game. Or if you play the King's Indian, you're going to play King's Indian middle game or whatever. So it's like, actually, I think it's more fruitful to study the middle game positions because those ideas will be a lot more transferable regardless of whatever openings end up, you know, happening.
Yeah. Wow. That is a ton of great advice, Koshi. I love your answer to that. That is some really good stuff. Okay. Second follower question from Shivering Bacon. Do you think improvers would be better off if they didn't check opponents' rating before their OTB games?
That's a tough one. I mean, okay, that's obviously hard in practice because generally it just kind of comes hand in hand with the pairing. Let's lay out a couple thoughts. I mean, usually you do know the strength of the opponent, and it does affect most players, I would say. Like the stronger your opponent, the more seriously you are to take them, and the more scared of them you might be. You know, the game is definitely different whether you're playing someone that's lower rated or higher rated. I think that's kind of natural. I think in general you shouldn't change up how you play based on the strength of your opponent. There are certain things you can adjust. Like if you've played with a certain player many times and you know, for example, that they don't like closed positions or they don't like open positions, and then you want to kind of adjust your strategy against them during that game, I think that's totally valid. But I think in general, yeah, we want to try to be kind of like as objective as we can when we're playing someone. So just because someone's lower rated doesn't mean we shouldn't be taking them super seriously, and we shouldn't assume that their moves are bad. That's how you just get into trouble very easily these days, is if you just assume your opponent's moves are not good. I mean, people are underrated. So people know, I mean, it's just very dangerous nowadays to underestimate your opponent. You definitely don't want to do that. So I think in theory, if you could mask your opponent's rating every time, I don't think that would be harmful. I think it could help a lot of people, but it is obviously just like hard to achieve. At my level, I mean, it's like, it's almost non-existent because I'm just familiar with a lot of my opponents. So I know them already by name, and I know what their title is or their approximate rating or whatever. So it'd be really hard for me to achieve it. But I feel like where this question is coming from, it's more about, it sounds like this person is very concerned with the opponent's rating, and it's like, yeah, that's definitely something to focus on. So I think a really common issue is like when facing high rated players, people generally kind of end up playing worse, or they do weird things, or they're like, oh, should I learn this like one weird opening because it might work against them? It's like, you just have to learn how to, I don't know, put your best game forward.
Well, yeah, I mean, just speaking for myself, Kostya, just on the practicality aspect of what you said, at my level too, I mean, I guess class player, I usually can't avoid it, right? Like when I look at the opponent's name, like the number is right there on the sheet.
Yeah.
And it's just like almost impossible to not see. So unfortunately, even if I wanted to, I almost can't avoid it. That's at least here in the US anyway.
I would say generally, like, you're going to have some idea, and also it doesn't matter too much. Like, let's say you're playing, I don't know, under 1800 section, for example, and you're in the 1600s, you know, you're going to be playing people that are up to 1800. So it could be 1700, 1600, 1500. Some are definitely going to be stronger than others, but like in general, no one in that section is unbeatable. So, you know, just try to play your best game. If you play your absolute best chess, you have a very decent chance of winning. And if not, that means your opponent played better than you, and that means you can look at the game and learn from it. I don't know. I have a very like simple kind of mindset to this thing. Like, I really like, if I lose a game, you know, it's just like, okay, that's fine. Like, my opponent showed me something. You know, I must have misplayed the position. You know, clearly something I can learn from this. Like, that's totally fine.
Okay, so to kind of close out our interview, Kostya, first of all, like, I asked all like my like big questions for you, and I really enjoyed everything that you had to say. This part just kind of just a handful of fun questions that I do now with all my guests. Though I wasn't doing it at the time when we did our first interview, so this will be new.
Cool.
So yeah, these are just supposed to be some fun, easy questions. First one for you is, who is your favorite player of all time?
Ooh, tough one. dang, all time, huh?
Perhaps a fun question, but not an easy one. I misspoke.
Yeah. and my favorite player. Ooh, that's tough. Okay, in terms of a player, I probably go with Fischer as a player.
Cool. If you could play a great player of the past who is no longer alive, who would it be?
Uh-oh. I would love to play Tal. I think that would be a fascinating experience.
Great choice.
I wouldn't believe if him. I'm gonna take all his stuff.
If you could play any of the top players in the world right now, who would it be?
I don't think I've ever played Magnus, actually, so I would definitely play him.
Hmm. Awesome. What's your favorite opening as white?
I think the Open Sicilian is the one I'm most attracted to.
Favorite opening as black?
So black gotta be the King's Indian Defense.
And this is a total fun question here. If a chess genie existed, quote unquote, and could grant you any one chess wish, what would you wish for?
Oh, any chess wish?
Yep.
Oh, this is easy, actually. No, I've been asked these kinds of questions a lot recently, so I'm well prepared for this.
Okay, good.
I would ask to be like 28, probably like 2800 strength. So I don't want to be like just the strongest player in the world. I don't want to have a high rating and have my current strength, because then I'm just going to go down. And I don't just want to be the strongest player in the world to the point of where it's like boring. I want to be just like super strong, but with like room to improve.
Nice. I love that. That's a great answer. Well, those are all my questions for you, Kostya, and especially in this fun segment too. So, I just want to say thank you again for coming onto the show again, talking with me about all stuff chess. I'm glad we got to do like a variety of topics to kind of, pair with the other one where we did a specific topic. So this was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed everything that you said, and I'm cheering you on for that Grandmaster title, Kostya. And I think, as I said already, what you were doing with Jesse and David with Chess Dojo and the training program is just such fantastic stuff. I admire all of it, and I just think it's a great, great service to the community. So thank you for being on the show.
Well, thanks, Daniel. I really appreciate that. I do. And thank you for having me on and for doing all these great interviews. I think it's also a fantastic service to the chess community.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, my pleasure. And thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for listening. This has been a production of my business, Adult Chess Academy. And that has a website with the same name if you want to look for it. You can also find me being way too active on Twitter by searching my username, Lona_chess. See you next week.